You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right on Radio, John Copenhaver returns to Right on Radio to discuss his new mystery, The Savage Kind. His previous novel, Dodging and Burning, won the Cavity Award. John writes a crime fiction column for Lambda Literary Journal, co-hosts the House of Mystery radio show, and is a six-time recipient of artist fellowships from the D.C. Commission of the Arts and Humanities.
I'm Annie Harview. In the last part of the hour, Dave Fettig will interview three editors of What We Hunger For, Refugee and Immigrant Stories About Food and Family, the new collection from the University of Minnesota Press that explores the intimate bonds of food, family, and migration. The book includes pieces from 14 writers from refugee and immigrant communities in Minnesota and their relationships with food, cooking, and eating. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Hi, this is Liz Olds, and we're talking to John Copenhaver. Are you there, John?
Hi, Liz. So happy to be back.
Yes, I know. It is good to have you back, and it was good to read this book in comparison to the other book. It was fun. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book and do the reading?
Sure. So The Savage Kind is my homage to the femme fatale. I think it's kind of the coming of age story that I kind of always I'd hoped that she would get. So I wrote it myself. It's set in Washington D.C. in 1948, and my two lead characters are two 17-year-old teenage girls who are very different. Philippa is very much the traditional teenager of the time period. And she is attracted to another girl named Judy Peabody, who is everything but the typical teenager from the time period. She cuts a wide swath through the local high school in D.C. But they connect over a love of literature and their very enchanting English teacher, Miss Martins. When Miss Martins loans Philippa a book, Philippa goes to return the book and finds Miss Martin being attacked in the shadows. She doesn't know what she's seen. And then a little bit later, a classmate of theirs, this brooding boy, seems to be having a simmering rage at both the girls and Miss Martin, goes missing and winds up dead. And so they decide to solve the case of and figure out what went on, which takes them into pretty dark moral territory. So it becomes kind of they become both crime solvers and get involved in some transgressive behavior of their own and maybe even murder. So playing around with the tropes. And I thought that I would read from the prologue, so it doesn't need a lot of setup other than what I've given you. It's just the first couple of pages. So here goes. If I tell you the truth about Judy and Philippa, I'm going to lie. Not because I want to, but because to tell the story right, I have to. As girls, they were avid documentarians. Each armed with journals and buckets of pens, convinced that future generations would pore over their words. Everything they did was a performance. Everything they wrote assumed an audience. After all, autobiographers are self-serving, aggrandizing. Memoirists embellish. It's unavoidable. To write down your memories is an act of invention. To arrange them in the best, most compelling order, a bold gesture. Some of the diary entries that follow are verbatim, lifted directly from the source, but others are enhanced and reshaped. I reserve my right to shade in the empty spaces, to color between the lines, to lie. You may balk, dear reader, but I don't care. I need to get this right. I could take different approaches. I could contrast the teenage girls, the black hat and the white, the harpy and the angel, the cunning vamp and the doe-eyed boob. Or I could draw them together, a single unit, Lucy and Ethel, Anthony and Cleopatra, Gertrude and Alice, Watson and Holmes, or even, I dare say, Leopold and Loeb. But neither of those angles would work. The complicated facts are inescapable. These girls are both separate and together, both unified and distinct. They solve mysteries together, and yes, they kill together. But many times they followed their own paths and even crossed one another. Things are never that simple, never that black or white, that good or evil, that true or false. I'm not writing this to assign blame or to ask forgiveness or to tie it up in a bow for posterity. It's not that kind of book. After all, an act of violence committed by one may have originated in the heart of the other. That's to say, this is a story about sisters, and like many of those dusty, gruesome stories from ancient literature, here sisterhood is sealed with blood. I should know, I was one of them. It's 1963 now, and I'm 31. A few months ago, Khrushchev, Castro, and Kennedy brought us to the brink of apocalypse. There's nothing like flirting with nuclear war to churn up mortal thoughts, to urge you to comb over the past and reconnect with old friends. With that in mind, I hope these pages reach my partner in crime, my only true friend, and nudge her out of hiding. I hope she reads this and knows that I understand her, that I love her, and that more than anything, I want to see her again. It's time. By now, I'm sure you're wondering who I am, which girl, which woman, I should say, the Harpy or the Angel, Leopold or Loeb. Whose story is this? Well, I'm not telling, not yet. I hear a cry, don't be so manipulative. But this story is all about manipulation. So why, dear reader, should I spare you? Sink into it. And don't worry, you'll know everything before it's over. I promise.
That's John Copenhaver reading from The Savage Kind, his new book. And we are here together to talk about it. One thing, it's funny, you talked about this, but maybe we can go further with it. You know, Judy is
sure.
The bad girl. And I'm using air quotes.
There. Right. Yeah,
and
right.
Philippa is the good girl, again, air quotes.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. It seems to me, as I read it, that each has a little bit of the other, and maybe, you know, Judy wants to be a good girl and Philippa wants to be a bad girl. I got that sense that it wasn't all clear cut, and I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in that sort of dichotomy, and it's actually a dichotomy between, like, the good girl, bad girl dichotomy that comes up in a lot of film noir. Sort of traditional film noir from the 1940s and it's, you know, based on a lot of detective fiction from the 30s and 40s. And I wanted to complicate that idea, and suggest sort of character complexity that both, girls have darkness in them, and how you sort of appear outwardly doesn't always correlate to who you are, on the inside, so to speak. But I also want to keep it complicated. I don't think either one is sort of a saint. but I think that, I think it's part of growing up. And certainly I, as I wrote this, I mean, it's definitely a mystery, but it's also, I think, a coming of age story. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, constantly have them navigating complex moral territory, which means neither one is going to be purely a black hat or a white hat in the story. They're going to be complicated characters, as we all are.
The character that was the least complicated in my mind, but also sort of the one that makes the world a little bit better place, is Miss Martins. She is able to reach to Judy as well as Philippa. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Miss Martins is sort of, in a lot of ways, well, I want to back up a little bit. I was very interested about writing about women in this time period because, and it correlates directly with the girls are actually, would be my mother's age at that time. And so I think I'm very interested in the way that sort of options for women opened up during the war, but then starting to close down in the 1950s. And so Miss Martin sort of represents a modern woman, a representation for Judy and Philippa of who they could be, independent-minded, outspoken, incredibly intelligent, stylish as well, and seemingly independent. And that was very important for me to have that character, for them to look up to. And Miss Martin's, of course, does get complicated a little bit later, but she gets, I think more importantly, the way the girls see her becomes complicated. And how they changed in their thoughts about her, because she kind of comes across as this, ideal. And in truth, she's a little more like Miss Jean Brody. But the one thing that they all kind of bond over is their love of literature, of storytelling, and then eventually, detective fiction as well as part of that whole landscape.
Judy, why does Philippa want to be friends with Judy so badly, and why does she keep up trying after Judy has clearly rejected her several times?
I think that she recognizes in Judy's outward appearance sort of the darkness in her own heart. She sees a girl who is externalizing her anger and her loss and her frustration in a way that Philippa has not found a way to sort of, she's not found a way to externalize that, but she recognizes it. She's very much the pleaser at the beginning of the book. She tells her teachers what they want to hear. She tells her parents what they want to hear. She looks the part. But when the sort of girls at school want to embrace her that look like her, she doesn't like them at all. She just doesn't feel connected to them. And as soon as she sees Judy, she's like, okay, that's who I actually am on the inside. Mm-hmm. And here's this girl who's brave enough to be a bit of the rebel and push the boundaries and is disliked. I think that is the connection. In a lot of ways, they are similar, although they, of course, have very different backstories and family stories, but there's a kind of a commonality in the way that they see the world. In fact, later in the novel, Philippa gets frustrated with Judy when Judy seems to be becoming a little too mushy for her. And so she gripes about it. And which sort of was the kind of this point of like, oh, well, maybe there's a sort of a turn or flip here. It's going on with their relationship a little bit. Who's the tough one ultimately? And I don't know if I necessarily resolve that. I think I try to keep it complicated, but I wanted to play around with that dynamic.
Yeah, it does get complicated. There's a little GLBT content in there, and we wonder what's mm-hmm. going to happen and what happens. I never read the end of a mystery when I am getting ready for an interview because I don't want to give away any spoilers. So I don't know if that... how that ends, so if you want to talk about that or how you decided to put that content in or, however you'd like to talk about that.
You mean sort of like how I position their growth as characters? Or,
yes.
Well, I think that, without giving away spoilers myself, the one thing I'm as a writer in general, very interested in doing is, making sure that plot and character align. So that the twists in the plot have to do with character growth. They're not just sort of I haven't just constructed this machine for characters to sort of carry out roles, but it's really, the shifts are really connected to who they are. And so a lot of the plot twists have to do with identity. in the savage kind. You know, who are your parents? Where, you know, what's your real background? You know, what happened to your mother in Philippa's case? Like, all this stuff, I think, is, and those twists tell us more, the girls sort of discover more about themselves as they get closer to that. And I try to use the mystery of Miss Martin's and then their classmate Cleve, who goes missing, as a tool to continue to, you know, enrich the character development. So that you know, I'm not just creating a plot to fit characters into, but rather the characters are kind of creating the plot on their own. And so I think the twists about Adeniyi are just as important as the whodunit aspect of it, which it definitely has. And you do get answers, and even embedded in some of those answers are answers to other things. And then I leave some things open. Because I am writing a trilogy, so my hope is that there's some threads that are will be sort of pulled into the next book, and then finally the last book about these girls, or into their womanhood and into the 60s.
I was going to say, are they going to age, or you just keep writing about them at the age they're at now? It sounds like they're going to age some.
Yeah, the second book is set in 1954, and the third in 1963.
Okay.
So they're definitely going to age, and which is, I think, going to be really fun to write. I like to think of it as the Mad Men arc, like it's the same time, basic time period.
Oh, okay.
I mean, not at all related to that, but it's that sort of that time, sort of investigating that through these two characters. Each will have it sort of its own mystery, but there'll also be elements that will continue to sort of come back and be folded in as the stories move forward.
That makes me think. One thing that you do that's really nice, you ground us in the time period by giving events like Truman and Dewey and things like that. You give these events, and it's wonderful to read, to know, you know, and you get some about how Judy feels about Truman and Dewey and things like that. You get a little bit of reality in there besides just the noir mystery, which I really like. And I'm wondering how you picked, which events you picked and how you picked the ones to ground us.
Well, I mean, the Truman and Dewey election was inescapable. Like, how I almost would feel like an oversight that they wouldn't bump into that one if I'm setting it, you know, in D.C. in 1948, in fall of 1948. So I think that one was easy. And I had fun because I think it's interesting to have a young woman, one of the two, kind of be politically engaged. And Philippa is not, but Judy is definitely politically engaged in thinking about this stuff. So to have her, you know, thinking and having opinions about the election was just fun. And it also gave me more insight to her character. And equally, like, Philippa's kind of looking at Judy thinking, maybe I should have opinions about this. You know, my father has opinions about it. And so I kind of had fun about, like figuring out sort of, Philippa's sort of having some growth there that she needs to maybe engage in a way, because she's been very protected and isolated. Judy's had a rougher existence. And so I think that it was just interesting to have them engage with that. And then, you know, so you like to have these big, you know, world or national events going on. But then, like, all the little, like, bits and pieces about D.C. during the time period, like the streetcars. I mean, right. I lived in D.C. for many years, so I was like, oh, what an interesting, how Capitol Hill would have been different with streetcars, you know? And pulling that in is just, that's just fun. That's just me having fun with the sort of historical time period. But yeah, and there are little hints and nudges. Another thing, I think I mentioned the Black Dahlia at some point.
Right.
You know, I just little things that sort of give you some, like, I don't know, little indicators of what's going on at the time, what the mood of the world and the nation is at that particular moment. And I think one thing that will continue to haunt all the novels will be the, I think you, especially the next one, will be Huac's sort of persecution of LGBT people, particularly gay men and women in the 1950s, particularly government workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I have it a little, like it's just a little bit right now, but that becomes a much more prominent plot element and that will play into the next one, the next book. So that sort of, that build up to that is starting to happen. So, you know, at one point in a party, they look across and they figure out they're looking at Joseph McCarthy, you know, they, mm-hmm. he's not a character really. They sort of see him, you know,
yeah. he hovers
and he hovers and they overhear little snippets of conversation. And that's all very, not just set dressing, but it's getting us prepared for book two. So,
we just have a few minutes left. I want to talk about two things. One is, the point of view is very interesting, and I'm wondering how you wrote it. It goes back and forth from Judy to Philippa, and then there's the kind of narrator off to the side that makes comments on what's going on. And I'm wondering if you wrote one person and then the other person completely, or if you wrote back and forth, or how you created this combination of statements and points of view.
So it was a long journey.
Yeah.
With lots of revision. Believe it or not, I had an early version of this novel written in close third person from Philippa's point of view only.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wasn't working. And I wanted to make it more immediate. I wanted to get closer to Philippa. And then when I did that, I had to include Judy. It just felt like Judy needed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I wrote Judy's parts. And in some cases, certain scenes that were Philippa's became Judy's. And I decided to do the journal entry because I really like the whole idea, which is consistent all the way through it, about people crafting their narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of layers of narrative crafting going on mm-hmm. in this, which I'm just sort of fascinated with, sort of how we tell the past and, you know, and so I really had fun with that. And then like, the frame narrator came in as a way of sort of gluing together the diary entries, but then became another way of sort of crafting the past. And, you know, and ultimately you can decide and then who you believe. So, it's just, there's something about like the way we look at the truth and interpret it that I just want to honor, I guess, through using those different perspectives. And it makes for an interesting sort of plot elements as well, which you'll find out by then. So
when I get to those last 50 pages. Well, we are about done. Why don't you give us an idea? It sounds like you're working on your trilogy, but what else is happening in your writing world and your life?
Well, I've been teaching like crazy. I moved to Richmond recently, Richmond, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and I've been teaching at VCU and at a local high school. It's my full-time job. And then I am jumping into the next book. I have it outlined, but I need to get to work. Hopefully over the holidays, I'll have some time to dig in and continue Judy and Philippa's story, as well as some other characters that I'm bringing in to the mix. So I'm really excited to be able to jump into that and be writing again. And, you know, you do a lot of promoting for books.
Yeah.
And that can be fun, but eventually you're like, okay, I need to get back to writing. That's what I really love doing. So
your hand gets sore from autographing books, huh?
Yeah, well, at this point, it's like my Zoom room, I think, is starting to get a little weary. I have so much time on Zoom. But it's fine. It's actually been a really great way of connecting with both readers and other writers, which, you know, when I was touring, dodging and burning, the world was different then, and so I didn't have that opportunity as much as I did this time. But I still miss in-person events and kind of hope in the spring that we'll have some conferences and that kind of thing where I'll be able to connect with people in person. That would be lovely.
And you're teaching writing in Richmond?
Yeah, so I'm teaching at VCU. I'm teaching advanced fiction writing to undergraduates. And then my day job is teaching high school juniors at a local day school for students with dyslexia and learning and related learning issues. And so, which presents a lot of challenges and can be very rewarding too. It's fascinating to be a writer and with students who struggle to write. And, you know, I actually have I'm on the spectrum with dyslexia as well. And so I can sort of say you can, doesn't mean you can't be writers or creative people or the written word is your enemy. So I'm not always winning that battle, but I really hope that, they'll continue to see themselves maybe a little differently, and I have a chance to kind of connect with them that way.
That sounds wonderful, John. We have been talking with John Copenhaver about his book, The Savage Kind, which is the first book of a trilogy. I hope you will send us the next book when it's ready. And we've really enjoyed this interview. Have a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll let you go now. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Liz, so much.
Bye-bye.
Hello, everyone. This is Dave Fettig, and we are talking with three writers tonight. This is my first time with more than one, so I'm a little giddy right now, a little excited. Welcome, everyone. Sun Young Shin.
Thank you.
Valerie Deus, please stop me on pronunciations. And hello. Zarlasht.
Yeah.
Did I say that correctly?
Perfect.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, you all, for being here. I have so many questions, and I have questions particular for each one of you and your contributions to this wonderful book, What We Hunger For, subtitled Refugee and Immigrant Stories About Food and Family. But to begin, Sun, let's start with you. I think we need to ground our listeners with a broad question, and I'm going to put it this way. Why this book and why now? Take it
Thanks,
away.
Thanks, Dave, for having us on the show.
Absolutely.
Why this book? I wanted to follow up A Good Time for the Truth, Race in Minnesota, that came out in 2016. I really started already thinking about what my next Minnesota or Upper Midwest anthology was going to be. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wanted to focus on refugee and immigrant voices, because while that was really an important part, a big part of the Race in Minnesota book, it wasn't foregrounded. And I really wanted to make that the focus. And food was something that I got even more inspired to write about with Diane Wilson's essay, Seven Seeds for Seven Generations, which was the last essay in A Good Time for the Truth. So it just seemed like the food discussions, especially in the refugee, immigrant, and indigenous and Black and people of color conversations locally and across the country, so many things were intersecting in food. Mm-hmm. That I just thought we could really address a lot of the things that we care about and the things that we get joy from, but also that we grieve as refugees and immigrants and people from refugee and immigrant families. So I just thought that it would be, it could continue a lot of the conversations around race and culture and community, and also bring in sort of a, in some ways, a way forward in terms of how we connect, how we heal the land, heal our relationships with the land. And, you know, food is just something we all have to, we all need to do every day if we can to prepare food, eat food, share food. So it's just something that, you know, really can bring us all together as as a society, I'm hoping.
Well said. There's a lot in there to unpack, and I think we're going to come back to some of those themes. But before we move on to our other two guests, just a quick follow-up with Diane Wilson. We had her on recently with her new book, The Seed Keepers. I was delighted to see her mentioned in your introduction. You want to talk a little bit more about what she wrote about and what how her ideas sort of inspired, or I don't know if inspired, but... I don't know, inform what you're doing here?
Well, definitely inspired. She's someone who I count as a major influence just in life once I met her and got to know her work. So can I just read the one paragraph that I wrote about her?
It's a great idea.
It's on page 2.
Please do.
So I talk about how many immigrants there are in the United States, that there's 40 million people living in the U.S. right now who were born in another country, and that accounts for about a fifth of the world's migrants. And so then I talk about, you know, not being indigenous to this place and having been born in Korea. And then I say, a writer who has had a direct influence on me and on the genesis of this book is the extraordinary Diane Wilson, a Dakota author whose essay Seeds for Seven Generations I chose for inclusion in A Good Time for the Truth, Race in Minnesota. Espousing a philosophy of gratitude and reciprocity for the gifts of nature, Wilson's essay is last in that book because I believe we need that in order to survive and thrive on this warming planet. We need to be part of worldwide decolonization or uncolonization movements, including of our food systems. We need to make reciprocity with the earth a priority. And as Dr. Robin Wall Kimmerer, an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation and a plant ecologist and others passionately advocate, we need to heal our broken relationship with the land, and we need to bring our children. The penultimate paragraph in Wilson's piece speaks to this brokenness and the solution. Quote, today, many of our children are growing up in paved cities, afraid of bees, unable to recognize plants, and often completely ignorant of where their food comes from. And yet they will inherit this world. They will become its stewards. We are responsible for teaching our children that plants and animals are co-creating this world with us, and the lessons they offer can help us reverse the harms that humans have inflicted. As we say in Dakota, Mitakuye Oyasin, we are all related, unquote. So that's to sum up just how I think we need that really big vision for our planet and for our species. And then within that, each of us have so much to share about our food cultures and what they offer, what they can offer the rest of, you know, the non-refugee and non-immigrant culture in the United States, which, you know, now for a couple of generations has grown up with a very highly industrialized food system. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a little bit of an intervention in that and just have some conversations around, you know, what are we doing with food? Where did we come from? What's next? How do we work together?
It's amazing how much is layered into the food we eat. I confess I'm not someone who spends that much time thinking about it. I do now from having read this collection. So thank you for this. And thank you for mentioning A Time for the Truth. Again, thank you for that book. Ladies and gentlemen, you should check it out, A Time for the Truth, out of Minnesota Historical Society Press, I believe also. But now let's move on to Valerie. We'll take you in the order in which you appear in the book. Valerie, I loved your piece. It got me really hungry for food that I'm not sure I've really had, authentic Haitian food. And you have some recipes in there. By the way, we're going to talk about this later, I hope. But I think you should put out a cookbook to follow this up. But we'll worry about that later because there's so much discussion about food and all I wanted to do was eat while I was reading it. But Valerie, I'd like to get real now here with us, with Minnesotans, and have you read from page 33, the two chapters, the first one being getting my first attempt, because you really kind of, you know, bring it right there, right in front of us, Valerie, about how we need to think about migration and the immigrant experience here in Minnesota. If you don't mind, and I didn't set this up, so I'll keep chatting until you tell me you've got it there.
Okay. I'm at that page. thank you for this experience and for us to be here to talk about this.
Well, thank you for coming here and being open to sharing.
No problem. My first attempt to share was plantains, since they are easy and delicious. I fried both green and yellow to show the difference in taste and texture. While the family seemed to enjoy them, my husband's mother kept calling them plantations instead of plantains. Food usually helps people from different cultures connect, but somehow my mother-in-law found a way to other me for food. I've never asked her why she would do that, because I learned early that confronting a Minnesotan is a fool's errand. The deflecting, the defending, the denial, the gaslighting isn't worth it. Maintaining my food tradition and not drowning in a sea of hamburgers and hot dogs have become a type of resistance for me. Food resistance. And I just refuse to let the things I love about myself disappear for the sake of blending in. Roses aren't mad that tulips aren't like them. Violets aren't mad that peonies are different from them. Yet people feel this impulse to harass the different people into being like them, a cult-like need to force folks into the fold.
That's a nice example of the wonderful writing that you're going to experience in this book, ladies and gentlemen, when you read this. And we're going to hear some more from the Czarlash in a moment. But there's a lot here, Valerie, pretty direct and written for people in Minnesota. I'm not a native Minnesotan, but I hear you loud and clear. So,
it's a lot. I'm from New York. I was born in New York, so I moved here a while ago, and it is a very different culture. It's a very different way to interact with people, and it's interesting. It's just been, and I mean that in the positive way, not in the Minnesotan way. It's interesting. definitely.
Right. So how has you mentioned the plantain story in just a few sentences. You just call up a whole host of issues. Can you tell us a positive story about how food has maybe helped bridge this gap with us icy Minnesotans? I mean, is it all just trouble for you with food in Minnesotans?
No, it's not all trouble there's a Haitian happy hour that happens once a month here, and there are Minnesotans who show up there and there's Haitian food there and people eat and it's lovely. And
Stop right there.
And so there are.
We need to hear where this is. We need details on this Haitian happy hour. If you're going to, can you share that with us?
It's at, where is it? It's at this place called Heart Wolf, is that what it's called? I can't remember the name of the, and it's across sort of from the, I don't know why I can't remember anything right now. Okay. Anyway.
All right, we'll figure it out.
That's it, on Cedar Riverside.
All right. Area. By the way, that's where KFAI is located. That's where I'm speaking from. So yes, I know what you're talking
about.
Okay,
so yeah, then it's really close to you. And it's like, it's 2 blocks away from you. So it's
party time.
So it happens once a month, and I think the next one is December 11th. And I always go because I like to have the food, but I don't necessarily have the energy to cook. It takes time.
Yeah.
Lots of seasoning and soaking and marinating, and I appreciate the amount of time it takes, and I miss it dearly. But so I go there once a month and I have some. I often see those, you know, when people show up for those events, people are ready to eat and to connect and to talk about things. I think in my experience in general, when I have that, when I'm sharing Haitian culture or Haitian food, people are receptive. I think this type of, what I talk about in the book is just this sort of like, I think it's more of a clash between, you know, mother-in-law, daughter-in-law type of
right.
control of what happens now to my son in a way. Like, I'm losing this relationship and you're gaining this relationship. And so I'm trying to sort of shape that in some sort of way. But that has not been my relationship with other Minnesotans with food when it comes to food.
Okay.
Oh. Or at least Haitian food. No. Yeah. No, not at all.
Well, yeah. Thank you. And thank you.
And my husband loves it. So.
Well, that helps.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. Yes.
Thank you. Zarlash, you put three words together in your piece, which were very powerful for me, and they have stuck with me since: starving for belonging. So I'm going to ask you straight up, a heavy also kind of question. What does that mean for you, starving for belonging? If you remember.
Oh, that's a lot. I really like that resonated with you. Thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you again to reiterate what Samyang and Valerie have said for having us here.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I'm really excited to talk to you about our pieces.
Thank you. Thank you.
So starving for belonging, I think that, so what does that mean to me? Oh, that's such a big question. I feel like it's really hard to act one way at home and act a completely different way outside. And I think that when you don't feel like you belong in your own home, a lot of the times you have even more of a struggle feeling like you belong outside of it. And I think that it's just a natural human desire to want to belong. And we have this geopolitical relationship, this just political relationship with the U.S. and Afghanistan that is so intertwined yet so not depicted as such in the United States, that makes it feel like your representation, it doesn't exist, even though the undercurrent of this country is that there's always this war going on, right? So we are completely intertwined with Afghanistan. What happens in Afghanistan is so reliant on what the United States decides, that the country imploded with the evacuation that recently happened. And so I think that belonging somewhere where all savior relationship has been set up with two countries is so difficult. How can you develop a sense of belonging when such a deep power dynamic, such a unequal imbalance exists? Yeah. How can you belong somewhere where justice hasn't happened, where people are really suffering on one end of the relationship and people are really not on the other, not even barely even acknowledging a relationship exists? So it's hard for me to reconcile the Afghan with the American,
right,
and to kind of find a sense of belonging anywhere. And like, I think that the essay was just all about belonging is something that you decide. Taking away the power that other people are given when you try to find belonging through the approval of others, through the reconciliation of nations, through the reconciliation of seeing yourself and your surroundings, because you're there. Like, I'm here. I created that space. You know, Afghan American, if I don't see it, I am it. And I get to decide where I belong. Everywhere I go, if I decide I want to belong there, I'm going to belong there. And I think that's what the essay was all about, was just creating your own sense of belonging and how that, yeah, just the importance of that, that you don't need anyone's permission to belong anywhere.
Boy, that's a powerful insight. So this relationship, this power relationship, existed and exists across nations, across an ocean or around the world, but now here in neighborhoods and with other people. And you bring that with you. Yes? This is what you're telling
100%.
Us? 100%. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The word starving, I think, is pure poetry in this respect, because, of course, we're writing about food here. And to starve for something is a very, very powerful feeling, way beyond an emotion. It's a physical feeling. And anyway, it really resonated with me. So thank you. And and so food. Let's talk about food then, and Afghan food, and your experience with that here in Minnesota. Any story you want to tell us? Family, friends, or
I think
Afghan happy hours? Or I mean, you know, we're open to everything.
Yeah. Oh, so you want to know about where you can find Afghan food?
Well, that's fine. Yeah, if you want to tell us a story about that, that's great. Yeah, sure. Yes.
Oh, well, it's very difficult to find Afghan food in Minnesota. I think that a recent count was taken of how many Afghans are in Minnesota, and they estimated it at 500 people, most of which are my family members. It was funny. We have a nonprofit, Afghan Refugee Aid, that is working with the state to provide relief for the Afghans who are resettling here, because out of the nearly half of the Afghans that are resettling in the United States are going to be coming to Minnesota.
Okay.
And we're providing a lot of that aid. If anybody, shout out, if anybody would like to donate to our GoFundMe, we can find us on Instagram at afghan.refugee.aid. We'd love any support. We're working directly with the state to provide relief. And 95% of Afghans don't have enough food to eat right now. So sorry, I get really emotional.
Yes.
Especially the connection to starvation. So thank you so much for letting me plug that. But anyway,
Afghan food
is so hard to find in Minnesota. That's always been really difficult. And I talk about in my essay about how food is so located in the family because of that. You know, like you really have a hard time finding it outside. There are some really great restaurants now. You can go to the Ariana Bistro in St. Louis Park. You can go to Football Pizza. Shout out, that's my family.
Football Pizza?
Central Avenue.
Yeah, but, I know it. I didn't realize. Okay. I saw the name Football. Yeah. I see the name Football Pizza. I didn't assume. That's
funny. Yes. Yeah, they're my family. They're my cousins. Okay. So yeah, they're cool people.
Cool.
Food is just a really important thing for women, Afghan women especially, mm-hmm. because a lot of the gender norms in general, not just in Afghan society, but American, don't encourage women to speak in general, but especially having that double down on you, Afghan and woman, Afghan and American and woman, it's just really hard to speak. Mm. And so food is a really important way that we express ourselves. So, I think that when you eat an Afghan woman's food, oof, it's incredible. Like, it's just, there's love in that. There's care in that. It takes hours to prepare and it's just delicious.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, sure it does. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I can't believe how time is flying here, guys. Isn't that amazing? So we are talking in the week of Thanksgiving, which is a peculiar American holiday, but certainly peculiar in that we celebrate it by, you know, performing various acts of gluttony Thursday and so on. How do you and your families and relate to Thanksgiving, if at all? The American holiday of Thanksgiving. How do you fit in here this week? Who wants to start? Well, that's not a good way to ask a question, is it? Valerie, there you go.
I'll start. My family loved it. definitely. It was an opportunity to, it was so fun. Like we would, my mother would cook all morning and then people would come by in shifts. And so I would eat at one time and then take a nap and then come back and eat some more when the new people came. So it's like certain cousins would show up at one time, then another cousin would show up at 3, and then another cousin would show up later. And it was just sort of this like tiered eating and also opportunity to see people. People would come into town, people you wouldn't see all the time. They'd always come by and visit. And my mother made all of this food. She would make something special for me because she knew I really like shrimp. So I got my own special meal, and then she'd make yams, and then she'd make macaroni and cheese, and she'd have to make this whole bechamel sauce thing, and that was always amazing. And I'm glad that I never learned how to make that, but my sister does, so I just eat it from her.
There you go.
And the turkey was always cut up into pieces, so it wasn't never a full whole turkey, because mm-hmm. she always thought that it dried it out, so we'd have a sauce on the side like a jus, and then it'd have like that was my mother, that was her date. Definitely.
We're seriously coming over to Valerie's place. Zarlash, over to you. We have, you know, about 4 minutes left, a couple minutes for each of you, Zarlash and Sun, and we'll see how we can wrap up here. Zarlash, Thanksgiving, how about you?
I don't celebrate Thanksgiving. It's not really a thing for us, but if whenever there's like an American friend who just like adopts me for that day, I go wherever they go. So
how about food then? They share their food with you, and if you experience new things. Or
I mean, I don't really eat meat, so I have experienced like mashed, you know, I mean, mashed potatoes and things and cranberry sauce. That was something that I was like, whoa.
Hell yeah. That's good stuff.
And like, you know, I have had family where like they try to get together on that time since we have a break, but it's never like Thanksgiving food. We just eat Afghan food.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah. I don't. All right. Good for you, son. How about you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't celebrate Thanksgiving anymore because it's, to me, you know, in white culture, it's knowingly and unknowingly in both ways, right? It's a celebration of genocide and colonization packaged under like, oh, the friendly natives and this really, you know, the exchanges and things like that. And, I grew up in, you know, I talk about in the introduction, like a white Midwestern family. And so it was very traditional. We had very traditional, like Midwestern Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And my mom was a good cook, you know. Mm-hmm. So that, and we both my parents have very big families, like, so yeah, there were big gatherings. But now I do Friendsgiving because right now, you know, everyone's sure. Most people, not everyone, off of work, and so. But two of the three people in my household are vegetarian, including me. So we do like just a lot of vegan Thanksgiving things, mm-hmm. you know, but like wild rice is of course an amazing, sacred, delicious food. We'll do that. I do fresh cranberry relish, which is just really amazing. So it's definitely, an opportunity to be grateful. It's an opportunity to get together, an opportunity to learn more about, you know, Native history and think about food. You know, in this country, it's just so fraught. So much of the wealth, you know, all of the wealth mm-hmm. first is from Native land. Mm-hmm. Then it's America's wealth is really built on Black people's captivity and labor.
Yep.
You know, so it's just, it cannot ever just be, you know, a happy story. We have to look at really all of the blood that has gone into what has fed this country. So, yeah. But that's my daily life is thinking about these things. So it's not, yeah, but just Thanksgiving's just another day to, you know, have sometimes more time to cook. So that's, I'm grateful for that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know we need to wrap up here, but, your point about it, food, all of you, and what you're reinforcing in this book beautifully reinforces is that when we eat, we should be conscious of what we're doing. We stop at a what we consider an ethnic restaurant and, you know, we wolf something down and we think that's good. And without thinking about the culture, the history behind it, we're missing out on a lot. So that's this guy's big takeaway from this book. And really, this book really opened me up in so many ways to what food can mean. And so did all of you tonight. Annie, are we wrapping up right now? We are. I get to shake. You know, I wish I had a lot more time. We all do. Thank you so much for being here. The book is What We Hunger For, Refugee and Immigrant Stories About Food and Family. Thank you, son, Valerie, and Zarlasht. It was a real treat.
Thank you.